Let's go.
Welcome to Micromobility, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of small electric vehicles. We cover the best companies building these amazing new vehicles, as well as topics relevant to how they impact people, cities, and our planet. My name is Oliver Bruce, an investor in mobility and climate tech, and my co-host is Horace Dedieu, founder of Asimco.com and Micromobility Industries. Hey team, Oliver here. This week I interview Kirsten Heinecke, a partner at McKinsey and the lead of the Center for Future Mobility within McKinsey based in Germany. We discuss the role and scope of the center and the rising interest that they have in micro vehicles and the potential impact of a vehicle class that they call mini mobility, or sort of slightly larger micro mobility, on the transport landscape. This is an extensive overview of his research, including the emergence of the direct-to-consumer electric vehicle brands like Electric and Ride1Up, and the innovative hardware as a service models offered by companies such as Lug & Carry and Wii. We also delve into the promising growth of the German bike leasing market, including a company called JobRad, which I hope to have on the podcast very soon. The market in Germany has been enabled by quite unique benefits and tax exemptions for employer-provided bikes, so it was really interesting to explore this with him. We also went into the challenges faced by mini mobility startups like Microlino, Nimbus, Lit Motors, and City Transformer, all favorites of mine, as well as the lack of investment in personally owned scooters, even though that is a very big area of growth. We explore the potential explosion of micro freight, the implications of upcoming vehicle regulations in Europe, and the factors influencing the funding disconnect between eVTOLs, autonomy, EVs, and micromobility, i.e., why does micro get no money relative to everyone else? So I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I certainly did. There was lots of valuable perspectives from an industry expert with extensive knowledge on the broader transportation ecosystem. And I really hope that you enjoy that conversation. If you liked this, I'm sure you will also like Micromobility Europe happening on June 8th and 9th in Amsterdam. Kirsten will be there. And I am really looking forward to having him up on stage to share the latest research that the center has been doing. In the meantime, enjoy. And here is Kirsten.
Let's go.
And welcome back to Micromobility. We have with us today Kirsten Heinecke from McKinsey, from the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility. How are you today, Kirsten?
Doing well. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you on. Ever since I saw the first slides coming through from McKinsey a couple of years ago, thinking, This is great. Somebody else is thinking about this micromobility thing, not just us. I've wanted to have this conversation. So I thought maybe what we can do is, do you want to just take me through? I'm going to assume most of the people on this call have some context on McKinsey, but maybe just the Center for Future Mobility, why it exists, what its scope is, et cetera.
Very happy to. So the Center for Future Mobility, the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility, or MCFM, is really our think tank on the mobility disruption. So a couple of years ago, almost 10 years ago now, when we started seeing the ACES, if you will, autonomous, connected, electric, and shared, we thought, okay, we need a different way how to approach these topics. We need dedicated experts. We need dedicated people. We need dedicated market models. And then we said, okay, we need to set this up differently than how we've been working before. And that's when we created the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility, initially focusing very much on the automotive industry, eventually expanding into other industries. So we also now do a lot of work in insurance, in oil and gas, with cities, public transit authorities, and so on and so forth. And then ultimately also going into serving shapers, disruptors, startups, scale-ups, however you want to call companies that haven't been around for 50 years or more, because we saw that this is where the innovation is actually happening. And today, the Center for Future Mobility has around 200 people globally. Out of that, 40 people dedicated to doing nothing else than market modeling. And why 200? Because when we started this almost 10 years ago, I could claim I know the future of mobility holistically, which I probably didn't back then and don't today. But now you actually need dedicated experts for every subtopic. So if we're talking micromobility, you need different expertise if you want to talk e-bikes, if you want to talk scooters, if you want to talk owning versus sharing, and many, many other things. And it's the same for autonomous. It's the same for electrification and so on and so forth. So that's why we have this broad team of people doing all the fantastic work on the future of mobility.
And is it with the consulting practice, it's obviously you're selling your services into groups. Who are typically the ones who would be buying these services on future mobility?
So the clients of the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility are quite diverse. It starts from automotive companies that want to understand what the impact of electric vehicles, electrification is on their powertrain portfolio, as an example. We're also doing work with insurance companies that want to understand how electrification, autonomy, fewer cars potentially eventually change their motor book and what the impact is and how they can actually participate and how they can ensure these new types of services. We're working with public transit authorities that are wondering how they can eventually include autonomous mobility into their mix and how they can integrate all of the different mobility as a service solutions into their offering. And then we're also working a lot with startups and scale-ups, anywhere from companies that make scooters, companies that make bikes, companies that share scooters, but then also companies that make some part of the autonomous driving software stack, companies that make some new components for electric vehicles, and so on and so forth. And with these companies, we either help them to scale the business, we help them with investor presentations, fundraising, and we also help them in reviewing the strategy, pivoting the business as necessary, or in some cases, even with the classic McKinsey values, if you will, of helping them optimize and streamline the business.
Right. Catch you. Fantastic. So is it when you say future mobility, does it include, obviously we're talking micromobility, but we're also talking autonomy. What are the other areas of the practice that also were included? Do you cover eVTOLs in that as well?
Yes, we do. So by now, future of mobility for us is very broad. It's anything from how can you launch an electric car in the market, so a technology that's already there and many people already use today, and, or how can you even improve an electric vehicle when it comes to the cost, to futuristic stuff like probably eVTOLs as the thing that is, I don't want to say furthest away, but at least for many people is something that still feels a bit like science fiction. And we also cover anything in between. So we cover autonomous vehicles. It doesn't matter if it's for goods transport, for people transport, if it's on the road, in cities, on highways, if it's off the road. We cover any kind of shared mobility. So doesn't matter if it's e-hailing, if it's ride pooling, if it's car sharing, if it's shared micromobility, and so on. So it's a fairly broad space these days. We've been helping clients build battery factories even. So fairly broad space. And that's, again, why we need 200 people to cover it, because nobody's able to cover all of these topics.
Completely. So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is that you seem to have a kind of a real penchant for the micromobility. You come and you speak at our conferences. We've seen you write a whole bunch of articles on it. Can you talk me through your love affair with micro and how that came to be?
Absolutely. So I think it started actually when I heard Horace Dedio speak at a conference in Germany a couple of years back. And I was immediately intrigued, and I was sitting together with a partner colleague after the conference, and we said, okay, this is massive, right? This can entirely change the way how people get from A to B. Doesn't matter if it's scooters, doesn't matter if it's an increase in bikes. It also doesn't matter if it's new form factors, what we have started calling mini mobility today, so slightly larger vehicles. And we said, okay, we need to take a look at this. And we did our own analysis and thought, okay, how many trips can actually be cannibalized by micromobility? What would the market potential be? And then eventually shared e-kick scooters landed in Germany a bit later, and I started using them, obviously, because I talked so much about it, and I started including them into my daily mobility. And now, I think 2 years ago almost, I gave up my personal vehicle and have entirely shifted my modal mix to being fairly micromobility centric. I still use shared scooters because I prefer the convenience of simply parking it properly somewhere at my destination rather than having to take care of it myself, but that's personal preference. But I have to say, starting from a presentation I saw from Horace to today, it has been a fantastic journey that has changed my attitude towards how we need to move from A to B in cities and how we can actually make mobility greener, more convenient, more sustainable, but also more affordable quite massively. So I'm really thankful to Horace for having that pitch, giving that presentation, and sort of getting me and also others in McKinsey excited about micromobility.
I am really curious about the others in McKinsey, because I think one of the challenges that we oftentimes face, and this is, you know, it's not only micromobility, sorry, it's not only within firms, but, you know, like I do presentations to governments every so often about micromobility, and there's always a very dismissive take. It's like, oh, these are things, toys, they're never going to be, you know, taken seriously, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how's the conversation changed in the 2-3 years that you've been talking about it? Do you think that it's still perceived like that, or are we, you know, what would it take to be taken seriously in your view?
So I think people are being taken seriously, at least sort of in our conversations. We have the sentiment that micromobility is clearly a massive part, or needs to play a massive role in making this modal shift change happen, right? And I think everybody understands that. And people, and why? Because people have seen it, right? People have seen that bike lanes have been popping up left and right, that with COVID, people have switched, people have experienced themselves firsthand trying to buy a bike. And it's been quite frustrating in some cases, simply because there weren't any and the market was empty. So I think the conversations have turned, right? I think when you say micromobility, there's always this delineation between different form factors. Is it sharing? Is it ownership? And so on. And then depending on who you talk to, you get either some not so positive comments about shared micromobility and especially shared scooters. But I think overall, in the right circles, if you will, the conversation has become very positive, and everybody clearly says, hey, we need micromobility to reach our transportation goals, to reach our climate change goals in transportation. We need much more of it. And actually, if we're honest, it's also just better for ourselves, for every individual, than driving to work in a 2-ton SUV every morning, which simply doesn't make sense. It might have been convenient, but it's actually also not fun sitting in traffic. It's much better to zip by on the bike lane and sort of wave at the folks stuck in traffic.
Isn't it always? Yeah, I great. Well, look, we'll come back to that part, because I do want to include that in maybe later on in the conversation around how we think about we can cause change. But I'd love to hear what you found, because I think there was a couple of really important points that came up. You did a presentation for Micromobility World, which is now online, which I'll link to in the show notes, which I really encourage people to go check out. But the thing that struck me in all of that is, you know, the size of the market is obviously going to increase very substantially between now and 2030. And then there are very specific areas where you're like, your predictions for growth are frankly mind-blowing even to me, you know, and I'm thinking specifically around personally owned kick scooters. So take us through the sort of the top line of the pitch that you have around micromobility that you find interesting at McKinsey.
Yeah, so how do we do it, right? How do we get to our conclusions on market sizing? We have a model that basically looks at mobility in more than 2,800 cities globally and takes a look at how people move from A to B today. So what does the modal mix look like? And then makes predictions based on changes in behavior, changes in customer preferences, changes in technology, and changes in regulation. And what we ask people is ultimately, how do you move from A to B today? How do you want to change this going forward? And then we introduce certain changes into the questions on what would change if, for example, cars were to become more expensive, if you had to pay more for it. What would change if certain new technologies like robotaxis and robo shuttles were available? What would change if sort of the bike infrastructure would improve and you could more safely, more conveniently use micromobility? And then we basically do a forecast on how is this going to break down into the different modes. So we forecast overall micromobility, and then we break it down into the different modes, and we break it down by ownership and sharing based on our questions around, do you actually want to own the vehicle or do you want to share the vehicle? And why are we so bullish to your question about privately owned micromobility? Ultimately, we asked, what would be your preferred ownership model for different modes? We also asked for e-kick scooters, and there it says 63% of people globally would like to own their e-kick scooter. That still leaves a lot for sharing. It still leaves a lot for subscription-based leasing and so on, but ultimately ownership is a pattern. Why? And in our mind, it's fairly easy to explain. It's ultimately these types of vehicles, they aren't that expensive if you compare it to another mobility option. Also, the ones that you can see that are made for owning are pretty cool and pretty comfortable to drive and even pretty sporty to drive. So I've seen some of them. I've test driven some of them at your event in September in San Francisco, but also since then. But ultimately, the whole convenience of owning it, carrying it around, and basically taking it with you is something that people like. It's the same as the convenience of owning a car, right? And then we still believe that micromobility is ultimately going to be a portfolio play where people are going to have multiple devices at home and then just take the right quote-unquote device for every single use case. That can be the scooter, it can be a bike, it can also be a micro car, so a mini mobility vehicle for certain things. And openly, that's why we are so bullish, especially about the private e-kick scooter market. We're also quite bullish, obviously, about all of the other markets. So it's not that micromobility in other segments, be it other form factors or sharing, isn't going to grow. Quite the opposite. It's also going to grow massively. But private e-kick scooters are simply starting off a low base and have, in our mind, at least tremendous potential.
Yeah, I mean, the number that I'm referring to that was mind-blowing is that the entire e-kick scooter market at the moment is $4 billion a year, and you predict that it'll be $70 billion by the end of the decade, which is just, that is crazy to me. But also, you know, I mean, a very exciting outcome, right? And also a signal that people should go buy Segway stocks on the Chinese stock exchange, assuming that they're a proxy for that. I have no idea, but I'm just, you know, I do find it interesting. Yeah, look, that is fascinating. And can you share a little bit more about not only the e-kick scooters, but the other areas as well? So the other areas that you think are really, either in terms of consumption models or vehicles that you have seen come down the pipe that you think are really interesting based on what you've seen?
Happy to. I think when it comes to different form factors and how they're going to evolve, I think we are sort of still probably at 30%, 40% of the evolution of form factors, right? So in my mind, the diversity of different micromobility and mini mobility vehicles, if you will, is still going to increase massively. Why? Because I think there are simply some use cases that today are somewhat covered, but aren't 100% covered. I'll give you a few examples. So one to me is the whole commute on longer distances. You just use the bike. I'm saying bike because I think a bike is a good form factor for that, or also something else to commute. Right. For sure, vehicles are going to get faster. I think there are some companies already not only working on it, but they have vehicles in the market. But then we might also want to introduce more comfort to these vehicles while still being able to go in the biking infrastructure and while still not consuming as much space as a car. So in my mind, we're going to see different types of form factors, be that four-wheeled bicycles, be that some kind of microcar, vehicles that are going to be able to drive either on the bike lane or on the street and then maybe at different speeds even. So this, in my mind, is one area for the whole commuting vehicle where we're going to see significant evolution. To me, the other use case is basically everything you do with your vehicle when you're not commuting. So when you have something or someone with you that can be grocery shopping, taking the kids somewhere, going to an appointment where you, I don't know, need your gym bag as an example, and you don't want to hang it on the handlebar of the scooter like I'm always doing it, and I know you shouldn't do it, but I think that's another interesting use case where you're going to need a kind of vehicle that somewhat protects you from weather, but especially also gives you a chance to store someone or give a seat to someone or store something in the car. And that's where, in my mind, in the vehicle. I have to be precise.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
And these vehicles, in my mind, that's where the start is still today, right? So you've seen vehicles like, and I'm only going to name one as an example, like CityQ, where you have a four-wheeled bicycle. But then you also see companies making very cute and very nice microcars, be that companies like City Transformer, like Lovely, and like Microlino. And I'm only mentioning three as an example, right? There's tons of them out there. And to me, these vehicles that allow you to use them for basically anything you would use a car for in today's environment in the city, that, in my mind, is going to be a massive growth factor. We've done another market sizing of that. I think we talked about $100 billion before. We've now reviewed the market. I'm going to share more details in Amsterdam, but the market is, as a quick spoiler, is even larger than that, simply because we believe that these vehicles truly have a potential to almost entirely replace a private vehicle in urban use cases. So that's where we're going to see much, much more evolution. And then in my mind, the next generation eventually of, doesn't matter if it's e-bikes, S-pedelecs, or if it's scooters, is for sure also going to come. Maybe the degree of innovation is going to be a bit less than on the other form factors where we're just starting, or where these form factors are just starting to emerge. But in my mind, this is also going to be a very interesting area.
This is fascinating. Because this is kind of where I've ended up too. I'm very bullish on the cabined, some sort of cabined vehicle that is able to be on the infrastructure, this traditional roading infrastructure, but as a micromobility vehicle, which is why I've covered Lip Motors and Nimbus on the and Arcimoto on the show. But also keen to get City Transformer, and we'll, you know, I'd love to get Microlino. I know that they've got a very cute little BMW Assetto kind of retro vehicle as well. Because these all feel right, as you say, that they are, you know, at the end of the day, like, what is the use case within a city? It's oftentimes just short trips, but you do want to have some level of protection. The one thing that I do kind of, I want to push back on a little bit, and the reason I push back on it is because people have pushed back on me on this, is that the footprint has to be sub motorbike. You know, it has to be a motorbike or smaller. And so some of those other, you know, some of those two-seater cars that you see, like the Beetle in Amsterdam, or the Microlino, or the even the Twizy, the Renault Twizy, which was, or the Citroen, I mean, like the Twizy was like slightly too wide to be motorbike sized because it had the four wheels. And I think there's an element of like just something that is small enough that you can sneak through traffic, because otherwise, if you're effectively like a small car, you have all the downsides of a car with none of the upsides of a car in terms of traffic. So, you know, obviously that for me, it's around something that's narrow, and that involves then that like the defensible kind of thesis on that would be like, you'd have to make it tilting of some regard in order to be able to like maintain the narrowness, make it single seater, but also have a single person in the back, or have another person in the back. But look, I mean, it's a space I've been watching a long time, and there hasn't been much that's emerged. There has been a couple of things, but it's certainly not been like insane breakout hits. And I'm very curious for you, like Horace has a theory that there will be an iPhone for micromobility, that we are still in the, like, we're still in the Nokia, you might get like the Nokia communicator, or the, you know, some of the scooters are like Nokia 3310s, you know, with Snake on them and all that sort of stuff. But like, we still haven't got the touchscreen. And I'm curious what you think the touchscreen moment would look like for micro, if you were to pick something where you'd have a breakout hit of a vehicle.
So I think it would be fantastic to have that moment. I'm not 100% sure if it's really going to be the one device that is going to be the moment, right? But maybe it is. And why am I saying that? Because I think that the diversity of these vehicles is simply going to be larger. Also because different regions will require different types of vehicles, right? So to give you an example, I think in Europe, it is perfectly fine to have a vehicle that can do only 50 kilometers, because you typically don't need to go on a highway in an urban environment. Whereas if you want to sell that same vehicle, say in the US, you definitely need to have highway capabilities, and then the speed needs to be a bit higher. And then therefore, you also need to build in different features, right? And then maybe the vehicle in the US might also be a bit larger than it would be in Europe, because a city, an old city somewhere in Italy, in France, in Spain, also in parts of Germany, is simply narrower than a fairly recently built city in the US, as an example. I have to say, I have no clue what the iPhone moment is going to look like, to be honest. I think there are some candidates out there. So I think anything that is, or let's put it differently, that's what are the markers that you would need to look for, right? You need to be, in my mind, be able to go on a bike lane still, mm-hmm. because that's where in the next couple of years, the advantage is going to be. Then the vehicle needs to also be able to go in regular traffic safely. And the vehicle needs to then have a distinction at which speed it's able to travel on the bike lane versus on the street, if you will, right? So in my mind, that's one element that needs to happen. The other element is we need to have a serviceability of the vehicle that is close to what you have today in a car when it comes to convenience. But at the same time, when it comes to the simplicity, it needs to be as serviceable as cars used to be in the 80s, where you could basically do simple repairs yourself. Not that everybody wants to be a bike mechanic, right? But I think certain simple things, it needs to be so easy to understand that you can safely do that. To me, that's another one. And when it comes to the iPhone moment, I think anything that's modular has a big chance of winning. Why? Because I do believe that people will want to use the same vehicle for going grocery shopping, and also for taking somebody somewhere or going somewhere as a two-person trip, maybe two little kids plus an adult. But you don't want to have different vehicles for that necessarily. So I think having this modularity somewhere in there, where you can change, say, the back part of the vehicle from a seat to something where you can actually store something or so, like you could in a car where you simply put down the seats, I think that could be another element of it. But I like the idea of the iPhone moment, and I'm excited to see it. I have seen a few vehicle concepts that could be it, but I agree with you. I think we're not there. We're still sort of in the, maybe not necessarily in the communicator ages, but sort of in, let's say, in the pre-iPhone age.
Yeah. The handspring and palm OS age. Waiting for our, waiting for the fated intervention. I mean, who knows? I'm watching around as to like who is doing interesting work in this space. And, you know, it's Rivian has an e-bike team. I think there are others who are in that space. And I'm curious as well, because who are the customers for the micromobility business in your view that come to you with a view of like, we see this as exciting rather than we see this as, because like the traditional theory, right, from Horace is that OEMs will look at this and either laugh, like car OEMs will either look at this and laugh and say, this is not a relevant business for us, or, and so they'll ignore it. And so, you know, it's sort of like, it begs the question a little bit as to like, who will be in the space trying to do something. Yeah. So who's coming to this and saying like, we're excited about the opportunity rather than like scared of what it could mean for our business. If, for example, it's the total unbundling of the car.
So I could see a world in which eventually the OEMs, the automotive companies are going to start buying up the companies that have created these new vehicles, right? Or at least investing in them, because for sure they will want to, I don't know, protect their market penetration, right? They will also want to make sure that they can extend at the bottom end of the portfolio. They will also, well, the customers will actually demand it, right? Why are some automotive companies now going into bikes? Because people have a willingness to pay up for a bike that is branded from the same brand that they are spending already a lot of money on for the car. And in my mind, it's a good example actually, right? So why, if Porsche in my mind has built an extremely strong brand, right? Probably one of the strongest brands when it comes to automotive, and people are somewhat probably identifying with the brand. So obviously they would not only want to wear the shoes and have the bags and so on from Porsche design, but they would also want to buy the bike. And I think it's actually a fantastic move that they have done this. I applaud that. I think it's a great strategic decision. Now, the question is, will people that drive a 911 or something else on the weekend also want to drive the 911, or are they allowed to drive the 911 to go to work in 5 years' time, in 3 years' time, in 7 years' time? And I have my doubts. Or put it differently, would it be socially acceptable to drive the 3 kilometers from where you live, at least in European cities, that's fairly common, right? Or even the 25 kilometers or 15 kilometers in some cases, into work every day in the morning with a car? Or will it simply be either prohibitively expensive, not socially acceptable, or maybe even prohibited to an extent because you simply aren't allowed to go into the city anymore? Now, what would these people like to drive to get into the city, and how would they like to do it? Do they want to switch to public transit? Maybe. Are they taking a robo shuttle? Could be. Some of them would still want to have an individual vehicle, and I think we shouldn't entirely end and ban individual mobility. The vehicles just need to be different size, different form factors. Now, would a Porsche microcar make sense? I leave that up to the Porsche CEO and the Porsche team to decide, obviously, but why wouldn't an OEM that already has a loyal customer base, again, not talking about Porsche, but any OEM that already has a loyal customer base, eventually invest and try and offer that vehicle, including all the customer experience, all the service infrastructure that they have, giving a customer the experience? Because that's something that these new companies are going to struggle with. For sure, they're going to be able to create fantastic vehicle concepts. But the whole expectation of what it takes to properly service such a vehicle that a customer has, that's very hard to fulfill. We see that in some of the e-bike companies these days that have sold fairly expensive e-bikes, but now that they are that they need to service these bikes because they don't have a retail infrastructure, they fall short of customers' expectations. And I see that risk actually even higher. So therefore, this could be a good opportunity to collaborate between, let's say, the incumbent automotive industry and the innovative startups that make these new types of vehicles.
Totally. I mean, I can see that too. And there are particular... I do think as well that there are really interesting companies that exist that are like focused on design and are doing a really beautiful job in the design space. Where I was actually having this conversation this morning with some team who run a scooter company about the design language that's really noticeable, right? So you have like Van Moof, or if you had Van Moof or Cowboy, or in the scooter world, like I was thinking of Bow Mobility or some of these others that are really focused on beautiful design. And there's something about it which I think is still really undervalued in the market around the power of a brand of a really good kind of like quintessential design, because they're taking relatively unseriously as a bike, versus like you go back now, you look at Porsche now, and I mean, it still harks back to the vehicles that it was doing in the 1950s, and that there's been this design DNA that like flows the whole way through. Same with Lamborghini, same with all the kind of great brands. And I still don't quite have the right mental model, I think, for what micromobility will look like for that. But I think that these will be the great fashion houses equivalent in the design world of what this kind of these new vehicles will look like. And I think that those are desperately undervalued by the market in a way that we haven't kind of grokked. And I don't know how to communicate it other than to say on this podcast, I think it's desperately undervalued, and I'd love to have conversations with people who disagree with me or other things. Yeah, look, the other thing, you and I had a wonderful conversation. We had half an hour a couple of months back, and literally we had so many things to talk about. And I want to go through a couple of those because I think they were so interesting. And one of them was, this emergence of hardware as a service. We talked a little bit about Lug and Carry, and you mentioned to me that there were, the model that kind of we from Norway and Lug and Carry from Australia have adopted of leasing e-bikes or renting e-bikes on subscription is actually not a new model at all. Or Swap Fiat, I think, is probably the Dutch one that's very famous. But there's something that's sort of interesting that exists in Germany, and I was just wondering, can you talk through that and what that's enabled?
Yeah, happy to. So in Germany, there's something called, it's a bit difficult to translate, right? But it's something called a job leasing for bicycles. So ultimately, employees can get a bike that they lease, and they ultimately get it through their employer. And there is a tax benefit to that. So there was a tax scheme created how if you get a bike through your employer, you can actually get a certain deduction and save money on the monthly payment. And it's a super interesting market because, one, it's very popular. Two, it's grown from zero to a very, very sizable a billion euro market in only, let's say, 10 years, maybe a bit more from the very beginning. And it's still growing massively. And the interesting part about this market is that you actually have a significantly higher amount that is spent per vehicle, that is spent per bike, compared to the traditional bike market. So if you think about the average bike that is being sold, that's probably around 1,000 euros for this bike leasing via the job, it's significantly higher. So depending a bit on the company and the market, it's anywhere really between 2 and 5x of that. So really, really sizable.
Yeah, wow.
And why is it so attractive? Well, it's subsidized, right? And maybe Germans have the sentiment that whenever they can actually save some money on something, the likelihood that they buy it is higher. But this might be sort of me talking about my fellow Germans and our sentiment on saving money. But I think honestly, the good thing behind is that if you sort of get your bike via your employer, there's a clear indication that this is going to be used for commuting, right? So it's not only about putting a fancy and expensive bike into your garage and then not using it, but it actually puts people on bicycles and it replaces car journeys. And especially it replaces car journeys on the commute, obviously also on other journeys. And it has inspired people to actually not only have one bike at home, but even build up a portfolio and so on. But it's a really successful market, a really successful scheme that is not only creating value for the companies involved and obviously also for the customers, but is also doing something good for the environment because you replace car journeys and therefore and make people healthier because they ultimately commute to work by bike rather than by car.
Totally. My understanding is that there's like 2.2 million e-bikes sold every year in Germany. What percentage of those do you think would be through the job leasing? If you were to take a stab in the dark, I don't know if that data is available, but I'm just curious.
That's a very hard number to say. I wouldn't know, honestly.
Okay.
Can't take a guess here.
Okay. No stress at all. The numbers that I had heard for that section,
yeah,
that sector is like over $3 billion a year. Oh, sorry, 3 billion euros a year,
yeah,
for just the tax.
I think that's fair. So I would say it's somewhat in that neighborhood, probably even more, and significant or still growing quite nicely. So it's a very good, very interesting market.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to having, I'm going to have the founder of JobRad, who's one of the biggest operators in that space, on the podcast. So that should be a very interesting conversation. Yeah, no, look, the other thing as well, and I kind of mentioned this early on, or earlier in the conversation, but it was around mini mobility. But I am very curious as well, who you think would end up building those vehicles. the when I talk about it, I'm talking like the Microlinos or the, because Microlino, it's a crazy story, but like that Microlino, which is the BMW Isetta retro reef, like remake, is built by Micro, the Micro scooter company, who like have been making push scooters originally and then got into electric scooters. And now I have gone and started a car company, which, again, to Horace's beautiful mind, is just the most joyous, wonderful kind of explanation of his theory kind of coming to fruition. But yeah, I'm curious on who the others are in that space. And because at the moment it feels like a lot of startups, and yet I haven't really seen, you know, I haven't seen a Porsche come down and say, we're going to build, they're maybe going to do like high-end e-bikes, but they're not going for the serious, like, we're looking for a small cabined vehicle that is going to really eat away at, you know, eat away and be a super premium play in that space.
So in my mind, there's going to be a difference between who's going to be designing these vehicles and then maybe marketing the vehicles, and who's going to be doing the actual building and assembly, right? So I hope that most of the companies in the mini mobility space, they're not going to try and set up their own assembly, but they're going to utilize some of the factories that are already out there, right? Are going to partner with contract manufacturers and so on to make the vehicles. But on your point on sort of who's going to be the players, I would believe that most of the innovation in this space is going to keep coming out of the startup scene, out of the scale-up scene. I mean, today we have probably 25, 30, 35 companies or so globally that do this, that have a vehicle. And there's probably even more that I haven't talked to, I haven't seen, I don't have on my radar yet, right? But I think this number of companies is eventually going to consolidate. And then, yes, there might be some investments from the automotive industry. There might be some collaborations. But honestly, I don't really see many of the big OEMs going down into these types of vehicles and trying to create them, trying to design them. Why? It's proven to be very difficult for these players to make money off of small cars, because with all the processes that they have behind, all of the engineering departments, all of the rigidity that they need to put into designing these vehicles, getting them right, it's going to be even harder to make money off of the very small vehicles for them. Right.
Yeah.
So therefore, yes, some are trying, some are doing it, and they will probably also succeed. But I wouldn't believe that the automotive industry is ultimately going to significantly sort of trade down, quote unquote, and start designing smaller vehicles, because it's simply not in their DNA, at least of many companies, to think of it like that. And for them, it will always be a sort of small car rather than an entirely new form factor, what in my mind it actually is and it actually should be. So yes, we're going to be able to use some components and some thinking of cars and some of the way or the processes, how cars are being designed, they should absolutely go into this. And we need some of the safety standards and so on. But in my mind, and at least that's my interpretation of what most of these companies have done, you need to start on a blank page and you need to think, what is it that I really need for a vehicle that it only goes in urban environments, right? What is the speed limit that I need to accommodate? What is the space that I really need for it? What are the safety standards I need to accommodate, right? What are the use cases I need to accommodate? Rather than thinking, okay, I have a car, it needs to work in every single environment. It needs to work in the north of Sweden. It needs to work in the south of Europe or everywhere in the world. It needs to work in 100 degree weather. It needs to work in minus something degree weather. It needs to fulfill all of these beautiful specs that the automotive industry has very much perfected to make great cars. I don't think it's going to work for Mini. So in my mind, Mini mobility is going to be coming bottom up from startups, from innovative companies that are going to be designing these beautiful vehicles. And then, yes, they might eventually partner up with the automotive industry for manufacturing, maybe for marketing, maybe even for branding to an extent. But I don't see them, or I don't see automotive companies being sort of the winners when it comes to the volumes of Mini mobility vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. And yet, I think this is the classic innovator's dilemma, right? Like, you've got a car they're all over serving, and someone will come along and do it. And if you can create a vehicle that's 90% of what a car is, you're just going to get, you know, I can see it, especially if it's combined with robo-taxis, right? Like, this is the thing that gets really, really interesting, is the conversation about like a small vehicle that's the same size footprint. Like, most trips are by yourself, and if you're going to be on the road, you're going to want a vehicle that is appropriately sized for your trip. It's going to be very hard to have, you know, if we had a giant flood of robo taxis, but they're four seater cars equivalent, and there's still only one person in them traveling to the place they need to go. we're going to start doing road taxes really quickly and pricing road space allocation. So it only makes, to me, it only makes sense that those trips actually in the robotaxis end up in a single seater vehicle for the most part, right? And then it's the, okay, well, what's that form factor look like?
I fully agree with you. I think even in the robotaxi space, we're going to see different form factors, right? We're going to see these sort of one-seater vehicles or vehicles that can comfortably hold one person, maybe one person and a suitcase or one person and a second person for certain trips, right? It doesn't have to be super comfy because you're ultimately only doing short trips. I think we're also going to see pooled vehicles, so vehicles that can hold four people, five people. That's a bit, to me, the European concept, because you're going to want to pool people, you're going to want to reduce the number of cars on the road. You actually have the density in most cities to do that, so you can pool people and still only increase their travel time by maybe 5%, 10%, which is going to be acceptable if it's higher convenience, if it's if you don't need to look for parking, if it might even be cheaper than the personal vehicle and many other benefits. So I think that's going to be that. And then I agree with you. If you're sort of trying to make something that's 90% of a car, it's going to be very hard to actually make it happen. On the other hand, what could be a fantastic offering is, why wouldn't an automotive company say, okay, for your use case during the day in the city, I'm going to give you the following vehicle, I'm going to sell it to you or lease it to you. It's yours, right? It's not shared. And you use it for 80%, 90% of your trips. And whenever you need something for the longer distance, here is a renting model where I actually give you a car, and it's all included in the same flat rate, in the same leasing rate, in the same pricing package. Mm-hmm. That could be a very interesting value proposition as well. But in order to get there, for an automotive industry, there are some hurdles. Plus, you would actively be telling people to not buy a large car anymore, but only use it on the weekends and shift a significant share of your mobility usage to smaller vehicles, which might even be an issue with the core business model. So I think there are some hurdles why automotive isn't necessarily the best owner for mini or micro mobility.
There's been the emergence of a couple of really interesting companies in the space. One of them is called Mobility Capital, who are like a private equity group that have emerged, and they... I've been talking to them because they're like, look, we just want to fund fleets of large fleets of any of these new types of vehicles, whether or not it's autonomous or micromobility or whatever. But they want to write checks of 20, 50, 100 mil, you know? And the idea is that they would come along and be able to fund this. And in my view, you know, the world of startups is, compared to how it was 20 years ago when you're trying to build a new vehicle, it feels like it's an order of magnitude easier. That there is, one, the ability of the internet to be able to search and find you demand. In other words, you can signal to the market that there's demand for your product in a way that was really challenging in the past. And then two, there's just a lot more streamlining of all of the things that would be required to be able to coordinate to manufacture a vehicle, and new manufacturing tools that are coming down the pipe that means that you can do smaller production runs without necessarily needing to have a $1 billion factory that you yourself have to build. You can actually contract manufacture some of the stuff. And then new pools of capital that are coming in that are going to enable for this. So I'm more bullish than ever that there'll be groups that will emerge. And like, I think you're correct. I think it is startups that are going to be the ones who drive the innovation there. It's just, you know, one of the things that I know you and I have talked about has been, it's still really hard to fund these things at the moment. And like the last 12 months has been really brutal. Can you talk me through, you know, what you've been seeing for the companies that are in this space that are looking to fundraise, what the kind of the challenges have been for them, and then how you've been thinking about how to assist them and whether or not you think the market will shift?
Yeah, so I think it's it depends a bit what segment you're in and also a bit what stage you're in, right? I think the probably hardest to fund at the moment is any business that has had significant revenue already, isn't profitable yet, is on the way to profitability, and has basically been scaling massively and investing a lot of the funds that they have raised into scaling the business, right? I think that's the type of business that at the moment is a bit hard to fund. I think most of these companies have done great jobs in making sure that they can accelerate their pathway to profitability. That's also something that we're helping some companies with. So ultimately, the classic McKinsey work of trying to optimize the business and optimize profitability, cutting costs left and right, in some cases also then obviously working on revenue to make sure that you increase the top line in the process. So
you're talking like they're like shared operators like Bird and Lyman.
That's one example, yeah. That's one example of the type of company that sort of runs into these types of situations. Right? And I think that's a big challenge. But in my mind, the fact that funding has gotten harder is actually only going to accelerate the way to profitability for this industry. and is ultimately then also going to accelerate the value creation. So while it is definitely a painful process for most of these companies, I think for the overall industry, it's actually, I don't want to say a good thing, but it's definitely not only a negative thing. No.
Yeah.
I think another situation is any company that is early stage, wants to make a hardware product, right, is trying to raise money for that, may also need to then either build up themselves some production capacity or find a production partner and then simply build a bunch of vehicles that is going to be quite costly. I think they're struggling as well, but they're struggling for different reasons, simply because it's ultimately hardware, right? And hardware, unless you don't have an as a service model behind, is always a bit less sexy than anything that's software based or services based. And I think here it's really about defining how you can have a good proposition that can be either hardware as a service or product as a service, however you want to call it. But then basically also not only targeting the end consumer and going B2C, but going into B2B markets, or if you're still targeting the end consumer, make sure that you also have some offerings around subscription, anything that generates recurring revenue, right? I think these are some of the things. And then I think overall the bar for startups and scale-ups to raise money has simply gone up. So how sophisticated does your investor presentation need to be? How much data do you want to share? Are you able to raise money off of a pitch deck with a few pictures, or do you need some hard data behind? And I think there the bar has simply gone up, which for us isn't necessarily a bad thing, because we're usually pretty good at delivering data for companies and making sure that the pitch is more sophisticated and especially more data-driven and supported by insights on consumer preferences, market sizing, competitive environment, and so on and so forth.
The one other thing that I just want to kind of talk through, because I think has been... And I certainly underappreciated it in my own journey in the micromobility market has been, as you say, distribution, route to market, things like that. And e-bikes have been traditionally sold through like traditional channels. Like in the early days, they were sold through traditional channels. You went through the same industry structure as the bike, bike industry. So you went to independent bike dealerships or wholesale distributors. And they would handle a lot of things, but everybody took their cut the whole way along, and it made for really expensive products, right? And there's been obviously the rise of Van Moof and Cowboy and these other sort of direct to consumer brands, which come with their own problems. I totally get that, and I think you've alluded to them around the servicing, etc. But if you were to pick, you know, to me, micromobility has this really amazing characteristic, which is that there's a lot, you know, an image of a vehicle that is you can kind of see. On the internet, and you have reviewers on YouTube who can all of a sudden get millions of views reviewing this one vehicle, which is crazy. And then people have that, like, I want to order this thing, and technically you can ship it to them. So it's not like a car. It's a lot easier to just kind of put this thing in a box and send it to them, and then they use it. You know, that it feels like there's a new medium that will emerge or a new kind of equilibrium that will emerge about how where this ends up settling. And I'm just curious about how you've thought about it for any of the companies that you've been advising or looking at.
I think we're starting to see a similar trend in cars, right? People are increasingly open to completing the entire journey to buy a car online. Maybe there's a test drive component to it, maybe, but for many people that's not even necessary, right? They simply complete the entire journey from information ultimately until financing, insurance, and so on, entirely back-to-back online. And in my mind, this is even more feasible for mini mobility and micro mobility, right? So I think, yes, of course, people will want to test drive. People will want to customize in some cases, and bikes are even more highly customized than most cars because you need to tailor it to your size and to your weight and to your preferences and so on. But in my mind, this whole notion of customization is definitely important, right? It's a bit less important, again, for mini mobility vehicles. So it makes them even more suitable for online journeys. To me, the question is, how does the new industry structure around this evolve, right? Same as we probably had it. I wasn't there yet, so I don't know, but I would assume in the 1950s or so, when cars were starting to emerge at scale, that this entire support infrastructure of repair shops, of gas stations, obviously, then the highway network, everything was being built to make sure that we can accommodate the increase in cars. And in my mind, something similar will need to happen in micromobility and mini mobility. So we're going to need this supporting industry that's already there to an extent, but in my mind is going to start changing or evolving as we get more and more vehicles, right? And why wouldn't there be entirely dedicated repair shops for high-end mini and micro mobility? And why wouldn't you leverage some of the existing infrastructure that you have in cities that today is used for car repairs for that? Because the qualifications that you need are actually fairly similar, especially when the vehicles get more sophisticated and when the vehicles are electric, right? So I think that's definitely an industry that in my mind is going to start being built up, either because the companies that are making the vehicles and are selling the vehicles are going to need to build it up themselves, or at least support the buildup of this, or because out of entrepreneurship, people are going to realize, hey, it's not only a good idea to be a bike merchant these days and selling bikes, but it's actually also a good idea to be a bike mechanic and make money off of that, especially when you're able to provide a customer experience that is similar to what you would have if you bring your car to the shop, like a replacement vehicle for the day, or even a pickup and delivery service, something like that, which in my mind for the new bike customers, for the new bike personas, is something that they're very willing to pay for, simply because one, they're dependent on the vehicle for their everyday use. And then two, if you think about the prices that some of these high-end e-bikes or mid-end e-bikes have for commuting, they're still massively cheaper than a car. But I think it's okay to spend a certain amount on service and on convenience, and people are willing to pay that if they already have such a high-end or higher-end vehicle.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's still hard, I think, for people to swallow the costs. Even though it's the mental thing, right? I don't understand it, other than the anchoring of, you know, bikes are $500 things. You shouldn't be paying $5,000 for a bike. Is it really 10 times better? You can make the same argument for you buy a super cheap car and then you could buy a Porsche. But for some reason, it's harder with in the micromobility world. I do think that there will be emergence of super premium, and that's where I think I think it will be a very interesting space, either through design or performance. And you know what that world will look like, I think, will become clearer when it becomes clear. It's still not quite there yet, but hey, look, I'm very conscious of time, and I just want to say, hey, Kirsten, this has been so fantastic as always. Really enjoyed our conversation. And if folks want to find out a bit more about you, how would they do that? Where would they? Are you on Twitter?
So I'm not on Twitter. I'm active on LinkedIn. There's a McKinsey website on the MCFM where you can find me. You can reach out to me. Feel free to ping me on LinkedIn if there is anything. I'm usually pretty good with responding to these messages, and very much looking forward to people reaching out to me about micro, about any kind of mobility. Always excited to talk about these topics. And thanks a ton for having me.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm looking forward to having you in Europe. We've got you'll be up presenting in Amsterdam in just a couple of months. So
yeah.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Very much looking forward to it. Thank you so much.